Open your Bibles with me to Judges chapter 8. The Midianites were oppressing Israel because of Israel's sin. God had raised them up to do that. It was a very severe oppression. God, after the Israelites cried out to him after 20 years of that oppression, God spoke to Gideon and told him that he wanted him to battle the Midianites. Gideon felt totally inadequate for that task and overwhelmed by it, and said that he didn't, how could he be the one? And the Lord told him that he was going to be with him and that he would defeat the Midianites as if they were just one man. Gideon needed a lot of reassurance, a lot of encouragement, a lot of positive reinforcement from the Lord, but he finally was willing to do that. He raised an army of 32,000 against 135,000 with the Midianites. And God said, there's too much danger that you will let this go to your head and that you will think that you have done this in your own strength. You're going to have to diminish the size of your army. So he told everyone who was scared to go home, 22,000 left, 10,000 remained against 135,000 Midianites. And God said, that's still too many. There's still too much of a temptation to rely on yourselves and to think that you've done it. Give the credit to yourselves. He said, take everybody down to the water. And he picked out 300 men from how they drank the water. 300 versus 135,000. 300 militarily well-equipped with lanterns and trumpets to fight with. And that's who he chose, and he gave a tremendous victory. Most of the Midianites killed each other off. Now the Israelite soldiers are chasing after the remnants that are fleeing. And that's where we're going to pick up the story in just a moment in Judges chapter 8 and verse 4. The problem of pride is a huge challenge. And it's one of those problems that sometimes gets worse the better we do. Increasing experience sometimes is counterproductive for us in the fight against pride because success goes to our head. And we don't always recognize that God's the one who's responsible for the victories. And so we can easily abandon the humble attitudes that we had when we first became a disciple and begin to be proud and overconfident. Now, it's kind of funny on the surface to think of that happening to a Gideon. Because he felt so inadequate, so incapable early on. And then to see him morph into a proud, overconfident judge doesn't seem real logical. But in some ways, feeling inadequate and feeling overconfident are flip sides of the same coin. It's still a focus on yourself instead of a focus on the Lord and Him being the one that grants the victories. So maybe there's some logic in that. But I believe if the story we're going to look at first tonight were told without the context of what we know already about Gideon, we would consider him as a total tyrant and just reject him. This is the part of the Gideon story we don't tell as often, I think. It's not very pleasant to tell, but we need to know this lesson. So, chapter 8 and verse 4. Then Gideon and the 300 men who were with him came to the Jordan and crossed over, weary yet pursuing. He said to the men of Succoth, please give loaves of bread to the people who are following me, for they are weary, and I am pursuing Zebah and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian. The leaders of Succoth said, are the hands of Zebah and Zalmunna already in your hands that we should give bread to your army? Gideon said, all right, when the Lord has given Zebah and Zalmunna into my hand, then I will thrash your bodies with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. He went up from there to Penuel and spoke similarly to them, and the men of Penuel answered him just as the men of Succoth had answered. So he spoke also to the men of Penuel, saying, when I return safely, I will tear down this tower. Now you see the idea. The Gideon's men are pursuing the leftover Midianites, but they're exhausted and they need supplies, they need something to eat. But these communities of Succoth and Penuel, they don't really want to help Gideon and his men because they fear Midianite reprisals should the Midianites end up winning. They're not so sure that they can count on the Lord being the winner, the Israelite army being the winner. And so they just kind of say, no, we're not doing anything for you. And it infuriates Gideon. And he says, listen, when I come back through, you're in trouble. Now, verse 10, Zeb and Zalmunna were in Karkor, and their armies with them, about 15,000 men. All who were left of the entire army of the sons of the east for the fallen were 120,000 swordsmen. Gideon went up by the way of those who lived in tents on the east of Nob and Jogbeha and attacked the camp when the camp was unsuspecting. When Zeb and Zalmunna fled, he pursued them and captured the two kings of Midian, Zeb and Zalmunna, and routed the whole army. Then Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from the battle by the ascent of Heres. And he captured a youth from Succoth and questioned him. Then the youth wrote down for him the princes of Succoth and its elders, 77 men. He came to the men of Succoth and said, behold, Zeb and Zalmunna, concerning whom you taunted me, saying, are the hands of Zeb and Zalmunna already in your hand that we should give bread to your men who are weary? He took the elders of the city and the thorns of the wilderness and briars, and he disciplined the men of Succoth. With them, he tore down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of the city. So Gideon kind of mutates into an egotistical tyrant right here. You know, we first meet him when he was threshing wheat. Now he's threshing men. And we first meet him shortly thereafter. He tears down the altar of Baal at home. Now he's tearing down the tower of Penuel to kill the leaders of that Israelite city. He's really the first judge that we've seen to turn the sword against his own citizens, to kill his own people. God had shown such great compassion and such great patience to Gideon himself with his fears and his doubts. He sure doesn't show any compassion or consideration to these men of Succoth or Penuel or their fears and their doubts. We're not now dealing with Gideon the fearful or Gideon the fearless, but more like Gideon the frightful. You know, he's turned against his own people. He's not relying on the Lord. It's like, wow, that doesn't seem like what we'd expect in Gideon. You know, he doesn't seem like he was. Now look at verse 18. Then he said to Zeb and Zalmunna, what kind of men were they whom you killed at Tabor? And they said they were like you, each one resembling the son of a king. He said, they were my brothers, the sons of my mother. As the Lord lives, if only you had let them live, I would not kill you. So he said to Jether, his firstborn, rise, kill them. But the youth did not draw his sword, for he was afraid because he was still a youth. Then Zeb and Zalmunna said, rise up yourself and fall on us. For as the man, so is his strength. So Gideon arose and killed Zeb and Zalmunna and took the crescent ornaments which were on their camels' necks. Now, this is a little cryptic, but it appears that Gideon finds out that these two Midianite leaders have actually killed his own brothers, and so he decides to kill them for that reason. He said he wouldn't have done it otherwise, so he turns this into a personal vendetta instead of doing what God wanted him to do with the oppressive Midianites. He should have killed them because they were God's enemies. Instead, he decides to kill them because they're his personal enemies. It's kind of interesting. He asks his own son to do it, and his own son is timid about it. Kind of shows the contrast with the before and after Gideon in some ways. And, you know, we can do the same thing Gideon did. We can take people who ought to be opposed because they're teaching or doing things against the Lord and turn it into some sort of a personal conflict. That is not the attitude we ought to have. I've always been encouraged by 2 Timothy chapter 2, which deals with the attitude we ought to have in fighting the Lord's battles. He says in 2 Timothy 2:24, the Lord's bondservant must not be quarrelsome, but be kind to all, able to teach, patient when wronged, with gentleness correcting those who are in opposition, if perhaps God may grant them repentance leading to the knowledge of the truth, and they may come to their senses and escape from the snare of the devil, having been held captive by him to do his will. the attitude that we need to recover people with is an attitude of humility, attitude of concern for them, trying to rescue them from the snare of the devil. We must constantly remember that we are fighting the Lord's cause, not our own vindictive sort of a thing. And so that this incident with Zeba and Zalmunna is also troubling about Gideon. But here's what's worse. Look at verse 22. Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, "Rule over us, both you and your son, also your son's son, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian." But Gideon said to them, "I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you." Now, of all things, the people say, "We want you, your son, your grandson. We want a dynasty of kings, starting with you, to rule over us, because you delivered us from the hand of Midian." Can you believe they would have said that? You know, it looked like, 4-1, 13-1, no way they could ever give him the credit to men. Surely not 450-1, and they say Gideon's the one that did it, not the Lord. And Gideon had gotten to where he was pretty much acting like a king, so they thought he ought to become one. The principle they have is right. They ought to serve the one that delivers them. They just didn't recognize the Lord, not Gideon, who had done that. Now, Gideon, to his credit, verbally refuses the offer of kingship. He says, "No, I will not be your ruler. The Lord will rule over you." But I wonder if their offer didn't, to some extent, go to his head. In Proverbs chapter 27 and verse 5, "Better is open rebuke than love that is concealed. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. Deceitful are the kisses of an enemy." Sometimes flattery is really a trap for us. They say, "We want you to be our king and have a kingly dynasty, Gideon." Well, he says no. But look at what all he does after that. "Yet Gideon," verse 24, "said to them, 'I would request of you that each of you give me an earring from his spoil,'" for they had gold earrings because they were Ishmaelites. "They said, 'We will surely give them.' So they spread out a garment, and every one of them threw an earring there from his spoil. The weight of the gold earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold, besides the crescent ornaments and the pendants and the purple robes which were on the kings of Midian, and besides the neck bands that were on their camels' necks. Gideon made it into an ephod and placed it in his city Ophir, and all Israel played the harlot with it there, so that it became a snare to Gideon and his household. So Midian was subdued before the sons of Israel, and they did not lift up their heads anymore, and the land was undisturbed for 40 years in the days of Gideon. Then Jerubbaal, the son of Joash, went and lived in his own house. Now Gideon had 70 sons who were his direct descendants, for he had many wives. His concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son, and he named him Abimelech. And Gideon, the son of Joash, died at a ripe old age and was buried in the tomb of his father Joash in Ophir of the Abiezerites. Then it came about, as soon as Gideon was dead, that the sons of Israel again played the harlot with the Baals and made Baal-Berith their god. Thus the sons of Israel did not remember the Lord their God, who had delivered them from the hands of all their enemies on every side, nor did they show kindness to the household of Jerubbaal," that is Gideon, "in accord with all the good that he had done to Israel." Now look at what happens. Remember how Gideon began his career destroying an idol? He comes full circle. He makes one. And the Israelites are unfaithful to God by worshiping this harlot. Gideon had no business creating an ephod. He wasn't even a Levite. So instead of accepting his own kingship, he invents his own religion and has the people worship them. He acts a whole lot like Aaron, who asked for the gold and made that calf that just came out. You see how power tends to corrupt a person. There's such a temptation when we have power to trade God's agenda for our own. And the more impressive our achievements are for the Lord, the greater the temptation. This becomes more about the sword of Gideon than the sword of the Lord. He creates a harem. You know, he lives like a king. He said the right thing. You know, saying the right thing can be a trap. We can say, "Oh no, I won't do that," and then we do it. but I said the right thing. You know, we the hypocrisy of saying the right thing sometimes salves our conscience in some of those areas. And then his son by the concubine, his name was Abimelech. You know what Abimelech means? It means my father's king. Yeah. So, you know, you wonder, what did Gideon really think about himself? No, I won't become king. But yeah, he acts like one. And he does things that corrupt the people. You know, after he dies, they quickly return to worshiping Baal. And I wonder if that ephod didn't somewhat pave the way for that. And after he died, wow, his son Abimelech, we'll see in just a moment, has none of his father's scruples, not even verbally, and he seizes power with vengeance. I mean, the lesson you learn from Gideon is to avoid seeking personal glory, personal power, avoid letting flattery influence us. Always see the Lord as the source of everything. I read one time a line I thought was pretty good. Some people were born on third base and they think they hit a triple. You know, sometimes we're like that. The Lord gives us so much, but instead of seeing the Lord's hand, we just think it's us. Look at all the great things I have done. So chapter 9. And Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal, went to Shechem to his mother's relatives and spoke to them and to the whole clan of the household of his mother's father, saying, speak now in the hearing of all the leaders of Shechem. Which is better for you, that 70 men, all the sons of Jerubbaal, rule over you, or that one man rule over you? Also remember that I am your bone and your flesh. And his mother's relatives spoke all these words on his behalf in the hearing of all the leaders of Shechem, and they were inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, he's our relative. They gave him 70 pieces of silver from the house of Baal-berith, with which Abimelech hired worthless and reckless fellows, and they followed him. Then he went to his father's house at Ophrah and killed his brothers, the sons of Jerubbaal, 70 men on one stone. But Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbaal, was left, for he hid himself. All the men of Shechem and all Beth Millo assembled together, and they went and made Abimelech king by the oak of the pillar, which was in Shechem. Well, what do you see happening? The seed planted in Gideon comes to full bloom in Abimelech. Gideon sort of acted like a king. Abimelech seizes the throne. He reflects the kind of the smoldering ambition in Gideon now comes to its full force. He goes to the Shechemites. He was the daughter of a Shechemite concubine. He says, would you rather 70 men, all of Gideon's sons, rule over you, or one man? And after all, I'm a fellow Shechemite. Wouldn't it be better to have one of your own kind? Now, I guess he's assuming that all the other sons of Gideon have as much ambition for kingship as he does. We often measure others by ourselves. I don't know what they would have done. But he's suspicious of them. And so they get him money from the temple of Baal that he uses to hire some thugs to kill the 70 sons of Gideon, his, I guess, half-brothers, on a single stone. And so they are killed, but mass murders, at least in the Bible, are rarely a total success. One escaped, Jotham, but the rest of them are killed. So this is a very poor way to start your kingship, killing 69 of your 70 brothers. Verse 7, the one that did survive. Now when they told Jotham, he went and stood on the top of Mount Gerizim and lifted his voice and called out. Thus he said to them, listen to me, O men of Shechem, that God may listen to you. So Jotham goes to Mount Gerizim, probably been more appropriate in Mount Ebal what he said. You know what happens on Mount Ebal and Gerizim. That makes sense. Otherwise, I'm not going to explain it at the moment. But he goes and Shechem's down the valley. And so he calls out to them. He gives this story. This is not one of the better known parables in the Bible, I don't think. But it's a really good little story, almost like a fable, that makes a lot of sense. So listen to what Jotham tells the men of Shechem who have promoted Abimelech to be king. He says in verse 8, once the trees went forth to anoint a king over them, and they said to the olive tree, reign over us. But the olive tree said to them, shall I leave my fatness with which God and men are honored and go to wave over the trees? Then the tree said to the fig tree, you come reign over us. But the fig tree said to them, shall I leave my sweetness and my good fruit and go to wave over the trees? Then the tree said to the vine, you come reign over us. But the vine said to them, shall I leave my new wine which cheers God and men and go to wave over the trees? Finally, all the trees said to the bramble, you come reign over us. The bramble said to the trees, if in truth you are anointing me as king over you, come and take refuge in my shade. But if not, may fire come out from the bramble and consume the cedars of Lebanon. Well, do you see the point of the parable? They tried to make various trees the king of the forest. But the trees that had some positive, important role to fulfill say they've got too many important things to do to try to be the head of the trees, and they declined the offer. They finally turned to the bramble, the bush with absolutely nothing positive to contribute, who eagerly accepts the kingship proposal. In fact, he insists on it. So one point he's making is that the people who are the least capable of doing anything worthwhile are the ones that want to be the big shot and tell everybody else what to do and rule over them. And, you know, the bramble says, well, if you want me to rule over you, you know, come and enjoy my shade. If you know anything about a bramble, there's just not a great deal of shade that it furnishes. And if you did get close enough somehow to accidentally come in contact with a little bit of shade, you'd probably come in contact with some rather painful experiences as well. So you'd be wounded to get it. And once he accepts the honor, then he's going to devour anybody, burn anybody up who refuses to recognize his kingship. It's Abimelech. I mean, he's arrogant. He's prideful. He has nothing to offer in the way of protection. All he has is a lust for power. Look at what he says in verse 16. Now therefore, if you have dealt in truth and integrity in making Abimelech king, and if you've dealt well with Jerubbaal in his house and have dealt with him as he deserved, for my father fought for you and risked his life and delivered you from the hand of Midian, but you have risen against my father's house today and have killed his sons, 70 men on one stone, and have made Abimelech the son of his maidservant, king over the men of Shechem, because he's your relative. If then you've dealt in truth and integrity with Jerubbaal and his house this day, rejoice in Abimelech and let him also rejoice in you. But if not, let fire come out from Abimelech and consume the men of Shechem and Beth Millo, and let fire come out from the men of Shechem and from Beth Millo and consume Abimelech. Then Jotham escaped and fled and went to Beer and remained there because of Abimelech, his brother. So basically he says, well, if you're acting in integrity, great. If not, may you end up punishing each other. And that's going to be what will happen. Abimelech in verse 22 ruled over Israel 3 years. That was probably a very long 3 years for those who had to endure Abimelech's rule. Then God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the men of Shechem, and the men of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech, so that the violence done to the 70 sons of Jerubbaal might come, and their blood might be laid on Abimelech, their brother, who killed them, and on the men of Shechem, who strengthened his hands to kill his brothers. The men of Shechem set men in ambush against him on the tops of the mountains, and they robbed all who might pass by them along the road, and was told to Abimelech. Well, usually, the success of the wicked is short-lived, and God doesn't put up with it for very long. 3 years is the shortest period of time in the book. There's no oppression shorter than that, no judgeship shorter than that. And the popularity of the wicked is just not a very stable thing. And so pretty soon the Shechemites start double-crossing their king Abimelech by ambushing people on the road, siphoning off revenue from Abimelech, creating chaos in his kingdom. And so in 26, now Gaal, the son of Ebed, came with his relatives and crossed over into Shechem. The men of Shechem put their trust in him. They went out into the field and gathered the grapes of their vineyards and trod them and held a festival. And they went into the house of their God and ate and drank and cursed Abimelech. Then Gaal, the son of Ebed, said, "Who is Abimelech and who is Shechem that we should serve him? Is not the son of Jerubbaal? Is he not the son of Jerubbaal? And is Zebul not his lieutenant? Serve the men of Hamor, the father of Shechem, but why should we serve him? Would therefore that this people were under my authority, then I would remove Abimelech." And he said to Abimelech, "Increase your army and come out." So the men of Shechem, the ones who have supported Abimelech's bid for kingship, now turn against him. They curse Abimelech. Gaal, who's kind of the new Abimelech on the scene, plays the same ethnicity card that Abimelech had used and challenges him to a showdown. And he throws off on Zebul, who's like the mayor of Shechem, one of Abimelech's servants. So in verse 30, when Zebul, the ruler of the city, heard the words of Gaal, the son of Ebed, his anger burned. He sent messengers to Abimelech deceitfully, saying, "Behold, Gaal, the son of Ebed, and his relatives have come to Shechem, and behold, they're stirring up the city against you. Now therefore, arise by night, you and the people who are with you, and lie in wait in the field. In the morning, as soon as the sun is up, you shall rise early and rush upon the city. And behold, when he and the people who are with him come out against you, you shall do to them whatever you can." So Zebul is informing Abimelech secretly that Gaal is taking over the city of Shechem. Verse 34, so Abimelech and all the people who were with him arose by night and lay in wait against Shechem in four companies. Now Gaal, the son of Ebed, went out and stood in the entrance of the city gate, and Abimelech and the people who were with him arose from the ambush. When Gaal saw the people, he said to Zebul, "Look, people are coming down from the tops of the mountains." But Zebul said to him, "You're seeing the shadow of the mountains as if they were men." Gaal spoke again and said, "Behold, people are coming down from the highest part of the land, and one company comes by the way of the diviner's oak." Then Zebul said to him, "Where is your boasting now with which you said, 'Who is Abimelech that we should serve him? Is this not the people whom you despise? Go out there and fight with them.'" So Zebul has a lot to do with all of this. He has informed Abimelech that he'd better come now and be ready to fight. When Gaal notices these men starting to come out of the mountains, Zebul stalls for time. He says, "Oh, you're just seeing things. That's just the shadows. Your eyes are playing tricks on you." And that gives him a little more time to advance. Finally, when it's impossible to deny that there are troops coming upon him, Zebul challenges Gaal's pride and kind of eggs him on to act impulsively. He says, "Okay, you've been so big and bold and brave to speak against Abimelech, now go out there and fight him like a man." Well, of course, the worst thing that Gaal can do is to leave the protection of the city walls to go out and fight Abimelech. But Zebul's kind of challenged his masculinity there and said, "You know, come on, you're going to do something about this or not?" And so he does. He rushes out with his men to face Abimelech and falls into Zebul's trap. So in verse 39, so Gaal went out before the leaders of Shechem and fought with Abimelech. Abimelech chased him and he fled before him, and many fell wounded up to the entrance of the gate. Then Abimelech remained at Arumah, but Zebul drove out Gaal and his relatives so that they could not remain in Shechem. Now it came about the next day that the people went out to the field, and it was told to Abimelech, "Okay, so he's dealt with Gaal. Now you got the regular Shechemites. You know, don't think that Abimelech is ruling over all of Israel. He's ruling over a very small territory. Abimelech waits for the men of the city to come out and work in the fields and then springs on them when they're totally unprepared to fight. Then he just destroys the whole city of Shechem, leaves himself with very little to rule over. You know, you become a king without any subjects pretty soon. And he scatters salt on it to kind of symbolize that it would be always barren, at least by his desire. When all the leaders, verse 46, of the tower of Shechem heard of it, they entered the inner chamber of the temple of El-Berith It was told Abimelech that all the leaders of the Tower of Shechem were gathered together. So Abimelech went up to Mount Zalmon, he and all the people who were with him. And Abimelech took an axe in his hand and cut down a branch from the trees and lifted it and laid it on his shoulder. Then he said to the people who were with him, "What you've seen me do, hurry and do likewise." All the people also cut down each one his branch and followed Abimelech and put them on the inner chamber and set the inner chamber on fire over those inside. So all the people of all the men of the Tower of Shechem also died, about 1,000 men and women. You wonder, can anything stop Abimelech's temper? Kind of reminds you of Gideon's revenge, only worse. And so this city ends up being destroyed by the man they foolishly made king. Then, verse 50, Abimelech's not done yet. Well, he's almost, but he doesn't intend to be. Then Abimelech went to Thebes, and he camped against Thebes and captured it. But there was a strong tower in the center of the city, and all the men and women with all the leaders of the city fled there and shut themselves in, and they went up on the roof of the tower. So Abimelech came to the tower and fought against it and approached the entrance of the tower to burn it with fire. But a certain woman threw an upper millstone on Abimelech's head, crushing his skull. Then he called quickly to the young man, his armor bearer, and said to him, "Draw your sword and kill me, so that it will not be said of me, a woman slew him." So the young man pierced him through, and he died. When the men of Israel saw that Abimelech was dead, each departed to his home. Thus God repaid the wickedness of Abimelech, which he had done to his father in killing his 70 brothers. And God also returned all the wickedness of the men of Shechem on their heads, and the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbaal, came upon them. So basically, Abimelech is trying to just systematically destroy the entire kingdom, it looks like, when, like Jael, this woman turns an ordinary object into a weapon. She manages to shove the upper millstone out the tower, and it hits Abimelech's head. And so the man who'd been responsible for slaughtering his 70 half-brothers, 69 of them really, on a stone, now had his skull crushed under another stone. And he was desperate not to have anybody say that he was killed by a woman. Who'd want that? And so he has the armor bearer kill him. Of course, you know, he doesn't really know what happens, I guess, after he died. But it's kind of funny because in 2 Samuel chapter 11 and verse 21, David mentions who struck down Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal. Did not a woman throw an upper millstone on him from the wall so that he died at Thebes? So much for getting his armor bearer to kill him. The news still was out. It was the woman that actually did him in. And so, think about what we ought to get out of this story. This is a bloody story, kind of an ugly story, kind of a detailed story. If you want to really get this a little better in mind, if you have a chance in the next couple days, go back and read back through Judges 8 and 9. Sometimes it helps once you've heard something to go back and think it through. But essentially, we learn one thing. Gideon's sins impacted his own family more than he would have ever realized. I mean, Abimelech is like Gideon gone to seed. You know, Gideon is a little more cultured and respectable about his effort to try to be sort of king. Abimelech is crass and crude and gross in it. But think about what that means when we raise our own children. You know, a lot of times our children will be like we are, except they may take the mask off. You know, we can look really good when we're right here in church and we're with our brethren. But our kids know who we really are. They know the kind of language we use. They know the kind of honesty or dishonesty we exhibit in our dealings with others. They know about our pride and our lust and our temper and our materialism and our pride and a whole lot of other things. I talk to a lot of young men. Find out a lot about their families sometimes. Sometimes with them grieving as they tell me things that hurt them so badly in their parents. Abimelech was like Gideon Jr., only way, way worse. It's really important that we be people of character and integrity, that we live for God, not just look good for our brethren. That's not to say that we will be perfect. And if we are humble and admit that to our children, that goes a long way too. But we need to be people who are striving to serve God sincerely and honestly at home, at work, at church, and everywhere else. But the main lesson I want you to think about is the lesson we learn from these stories about leadership. Leaders don't need to follow the pattern of Gideon and Abimelech. Do you remember how Jesus taught about leadership in passages like Mark chapter 10 and verse 42? When James and John wanted to sit on his right hand and his left, and the 10 were really sore about that, because it's like they called shotgun before they got the opportunity. They all wanted to be the top dogs. Jesus says in Mark 10:42, calling them to himself, Jesus said to them, "You know that those who are recognized as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. But it is not this way among you. But whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant. And whoever wishes to be first among you shall be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, to give his life a ransom for many." Leaders should be servants. You think about Rehoboam. He tried to be the big shot, and he lost most of David's kingdom. We like the tough guy image. We like the idea that we're a force to be reckoned with. But that is not the biblical image of leadership. Think about two or three illustrations of that. Think about husbands who, instead of lovingly and self-sacrificingly leading their wives, they do it selfishly and self-exaltedly. They view their wives as somebody they can order around for their own pleasure to get what they want. That's not the kind of headship that God is asking. Husbands who love their wives like Jesus loved the church to exercise. Think about parents. We talked about this a little bit yesterday. But when parents rule their children with a might makes right attitude, I'm bigger than you are, you better obey me, instead of with a desire to help our children grow to be like the Lord, you know, we get to the point where it becomes just a tug of war instead of an effort to try to shape the child's heart. I'm going to prove I'll win this one. We need to discipline our children, especially as they're younger. We need to train them. We need to work with them. We need to be their parents. But when it becomes a matter that we're just trying to dominate and trying to get our way and trying to show we're tough enough, we can handle you, that's not the attitude. That's not the spirit of a humble leader. A humble leader is willing to be where the buck stops, but is not trying to lord it over those that he leads. Think about elders. There are elders who let authority go to their head. They like the idea that we can tell the church what to do. I remember many times the best elders I ever worked with saying, as they would talk to the brethren and they would ask for input and they would listen, they would say, "This is not our church. You know, the church is all of us. It's not just us." I remember many times there was one brother in that congregation who they would meet from time to time with the men in the congregation and just ask for input. And there was one brother who would say some really harsh things against them. And they would almost never even respond. They would say, "Thank you. Appreciate that. That's helpful." And I'd ask them afterwards, "Why do you let him talk like that? Why don't you do something?" They said, "Oh, we're not worried about things that are open like that. That's not a problem for us." And they weren't defensive about, you know, everybody's got to agree with them about everything. It was very encouraging. You see elders needing to follow the pattern of the apostles in Acts chapter 6, delegating tasks and authority and not feeling like, you know, we've got to run everything. What you see is the importance of servant leadership. It's leadership. It's not an unwillingness to take the lead. Leaders have to make some unpopular decisions. They have to be willing to take the leadership. But not for selfish glory. Not to be able to run things. Not because we're tough and we can handle it and we can tell you what to do. But because we love and we seek to serve. It's not the model of leadership in the world. That's what Jesus was saying in Mark 10. And it's exactly what you see the problem in Gideon and Abimelech. They let their success, at least in Gideon's case, go to his head and make him prideful. In Abimelech's case, he just wanted to run things. He got a little bit of his father, but none of the sense. And you see where it ends up. Great lessons from the book of Judges. Things that we need to apply in our own life, in our own heart, in our own character. So many things that we can see. So I would encourage you, if you have a chance, to go back and reread those chapters and think about them. And continue to work through the book of Judges and just think about all the good lessons we can learn. If you're not a Christian, you need to humble yourself. There's no place in serving the Lord for those who exalt themselves. But those who are willing to humble themselves and serve the Lord, and live for Him, listen to Him, follow Him in their lives. It's what we need to do. He's the only source of life, of hope, of salvation. If you're not a Christian, we encourage you to come while we stand and sing.